Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we break down the hardest-hitting social issues in sports. On today's show, we take a second and possibly more significant look at the sports gambling landscape. In light of recent news and plenty of new changes, there is so much to talk about. My name is Chad Wiley, and with me, as always, now that he's finished trying to get to Washington, D.C. to take one final picture of the president, it's John Nekrasov.
Thank you. I'm glad to be appearing on the show this evening. I missed my opportunity to get a photo of the president because someone beat me to it. But maybe next time. Maybe next time.
That's a reference. Yeah, stay tuned to the end of the podcast for that reference to make any sense.
We have a movie corner. It's been a while since we've had a movie corner because there have been no movies, really.
It's been a while since we've had a good
speaking
movie.
About. Yeah. Like, was the last one, was it Dune?
Yeah, of course.
I guess that was the last good movie, like genuinely good prior to this. So anyway,
we've got a good one again.
We do. So we're excited to talk about that, but we have sports to talk about, which is very exciting.
Someone else
is also box office. And who is that person, Chad?
You tell me.
Well, I think it's Nikola Jokic.
I was about to say, as the guy who doesn't watch a lot of basketball but was locked into the game last night, you tell me who was able to get John Nekrasov's attention onto the hard court.
I mean the Denver Nuggets are my NBA team, apparently, which is like, yeah. I mean, I have no connection to Denver, but I feel like I have a heart-to-heart connection with Nikola Jokic because he is both an unbelievable baller and also just does not care about basketball. And I think that's really is kind of like, if I was a basketball player, that's the relationship that I would aspire to have to basketball, given my feelings on basketball in general. So I feel well represented by him as he comes back from like 20 points down to beat the Lakers yesterday. Yeah. We're recording on a Tuesday night. I don't know. The Nuggets won last year, and I mean, maybe they'll do it again this year.
Like you said, the Nuggets are up 2-0 on the Lakers. We'll do a brief little roundup of some smaller bits of NBA news before we get to the big story. But to me, the story of that game was that the Lakers basically played the best possible version of Lakers basketball and still lost by 2 points. So, like, that's not great to be like, we came out here and we did our absolute best. We were leading for most of the game. We were up by double digits for a lot of the game. And we still somehow managed to lose. Like, I feel like this series is more likely to be a sweep than it is to be a Lakers win at this point.
And I'll be honest, I went to bed. Like, I was like, oh, the Nuggets are going to lose this one. I'm not staying up for this. I am just crashing. And I woke up to a completely different score.
I mean, you probably went to bed. Lakers were up like 15 to 17, somewhere in that range. Yeah. Yep. Speaking of like crazy scoring runs, John, and you haven't been a basketball fan, and I haven't really paid that much attention to basketball when the New York Knicks were like an important NBA franchise.
Yeah, absolutely.
But playoff basketball in Madison Square Garden when the Knicks are good looks like a lot of fun. They're up 2-0 on the Philadelphia 76ers, and the game that they played on Monday night was awesome. I believe the Knicks scored 8 points in the final 30 seconds, including a sequence where they went from down 5 to up 1 in like a 10-second period where they hit a three-pointer and then stole the inbound pass, and then Dante DiVincenzo hit another three-pointer, and they go up by 1, and the Garden's going crazy. And that was just, again, like a team that hasn't been very good in the past decade or so. Certainly haven't made deep playoff runs. But basketball does look like it's a lot of fun when you're part of the home crowd at the New York Knicks home games.
Yeah, I think we're in a really interesting spot. Like once we hit into like mid late April is a funny spot in the sports calendar, especially with US sports, because obviously like the NFL and the NFL draft is firmly in its offseason. March Madness has come and gone. College football's gone. The Masters is gone. In terms of all the truly big ticket items on the American sports calendar, we're kind of done until the NFL season starts again. And what's interesting about this time, like obviously during the regular season for both hockey and basketball, you have like a dedicated fan base that are locked into all those regular season games. But I find myself every year in this kind of like sort of a dead zone almost for like the really big ticket sports where people are tuning in for the regular season, there's always something that grabs my attention in these kind of playoff series, even if there are no teams that I like genuinely actually care about, which I just find interesting. I definitely don't care that much about professional hockey or basketball, but I feel like they've both kind of carved out their niche in the sports calendar in a way that I feel like consistently I find myself interested later in the evening when my schedule is done for the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that there's so much glut in both of their regular seasons mm-hmm. that it's too much of a commitment to closely follow the NHL, NBA regular seasons. But once you get into May and June, like you said, where there's this kind of period where those are the two events, and whether you have a local team interest or you can just choose a team to follow, that can be a really, really fun month here when you have NBA and NHL base important games basically every night all from now until like mid-June. That's pretty mm-hmm. fun.
Yeah, and it's always prime time, which is very different than the NFL, which obviously like is a Sunday-centric thing with some prime time games. Like it does feel... Obviously, I watch way more soccer than I do either of these sports, but soccer is a specific time on my like weekly calendar that's usually like Saturday afternoons and mornings, and then like sometimes Wednesday afternoons.
Yeah.
I think I definitely like basketball and hockey to me are like sort of like Seinfeld. I just have them on, and then sometimes something happens. I'm like, no way, that was great.
Yeah. Speaking of the NBA, John, do you want to kind of dive into, start our way into our big topic for this?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that some people, you know, really struggle to find ways to stay invested in sports they don't have emotional ties to, while others really find great ways to invest themselves in sports they don't have emotional ties to. And that's really what this this whole conversation is all about.
Yeah, if you want to find a way to care, why don't you put $10,000 down and then see how much you care?
Or maybe 80.
Or 80. Yeah, John, we mentioned last time, I think last time we podcasted, this story was literally breaking that day.
That's right.
That Jontay Porter was being investigated by the NBA for what they were at the time calling betting irregularities. Now it's safe to say that it was just downright gambling tampering. Mm-hmm. To the most blatant degree. That report has been released, and attached to it is what I believe is the harshest penalty ever imposed by the NBA on a member of an NBA roster.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I think we can't like overemphasize how serious this story is, because literally, I guess it was a month ago now, we sat down and talked about the story of Shohei Ohtani and his interpreter, which, kind of backing things up a little bit, since we talked about that story, that interpreter has now been arrested and put on bail and may face, if convicted, up to 30 years in jail for being accused of stealing all those millions of dollars from Ohtani.
Yeah, he's being charged with stealing $16 million from mm-hmm. Ohtani,
which is just a remarkable story in its own right. I thought it was worth bringing up since we talked about it. We then spent some time, you know, thinking about, you know, what is the effect of gambling on sports right now, and we thought about it so much that we decided that we wanted to do a whole nother episode about it. And in the meantime, between these two podcast episodes, basically the worst case scenario story broke, not just of someone connected to the league betting illegally on sports, but an active player betting on games they were involved in to actively jeopardize the sporting integrity of the competition that they were in. That is the worst case scenario for the league, because that then raises the question of, is all of this a fraud? You know, and that's why the league is taking this so seriously. And there are a lot of different factors that we can get into about what that means and why that is. But I think when we look at this story, the NBA recognizes that it has a problem.
Right? Yeah.
And it's shutting it down now. But it's let the cat out of the bag, as we discussed. And I think we're going to see a lot more stories like this.
What Jontay Porter did is the most blatant form of like sports gambling that a player can be involved in. It's also the kind that jeopardizes the integrity of the sport the most, because in other cases, like in the case of Pete Rose, who's been permanently banned by MLB, he was placing bets on games that he participated in. But at least according to him, he was always betting on his team to win, which is still a problem. But there's an extent to which you can't do anything to make that bet pay off other than play your best, which is what you already should be doing anyway. If LeBron James was betting himself the over on his points total every single game, all he can do is try to score points, which is all he's trying to do anyway. Right. This is much more like the Black Sox scandal from the early 1900s, where a team intentionally lost a World Series, which is something that you actually can do. You can, A, intentionally play badly, or B, intentionally limit your availability in order to have your stats not pay off, which is what Jontay Porter did. He gave away information to a known NBA bettor and told him to bet the under on all of Jontay Porter's stats, which means that he would have less points than expected, less rebounds than expected, less whatever, all the things that would be less than what you would expect. And then 3 minutes into the game, he took himself out of the game claiming to be ill, which means that he technically had a stat line because he played a minute. And so, but I don't think he contributed anything to the game. And so every single under hit. And this person who placed an $80,000 parlay bet won $1.1 million, which thankfully was not paid out because that bet was you know, tagged as possibly suspicious and was frozen. But when you have a player who is willing to take themselves out of the game in order to cause a bet to pay off, you have gone to 10 out of 10 DEFCON, like the most severe type of league integrity, game integrity issue that can exist for this sport. This is like 10 out of 10 earth-shattering catastrophe kind of stuff, which is why it was met with a 10 out of 10, you know, career-shattering punishment.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the reality is, right, the worst case for any sports league is match-fixing. Right, because if people decide that your sport is rigged for people to win money, they won't watch it. Like that's just the reality. A rigged sport leads to obvious corruption, which leads to obvious disinterest in the product on the field.
Yeah, and again, we're coming off a year in which genuine people thought that the NFL playoffs were rigged, and not even for gambling reasons, just for like other weird reasons. But like this is not like this is a it's a conspiracy theory that is like believed more widely than you might expect.
Mm-hmm. Because sports are a sham, right? It's a bunch of rules set up for a bunch of people to throw a ball around a court or a field or kick a ball or whatever. And we all collectively agree that, yes, this has cultural meaning. Yes, this is important. Yes, I should spend literally hundreds and thousands of dollars to support my team, to support this league, whatever. If you break that illusion, no one cares anymore, right? And so the reality is Eric Kareen, who's like the lead beat writer for The Athletic on the Raptors, which is the team that Jontay Porter was contracted with, wrote an interesting op-ed about this. And he basically said, you know, to a degree, like this suspension, just like Calvin Ridley's suspension in the NFL, I guess it was last year or the year before, is about optics. You know, we've talked about so many like domestic violence stories and PED stories and whatever, things that I would consider, to be honest, to be much more serious in certain categories, especially like, obviously, like the criminal and domestic cases. But the reality is for the league, this is actually more important, which I think is a whole nother conversation. But players engaging in criminal activities are not an existential threat to sports. But sports betting by players on their own games is an existential threat to sports. And I think that's why we're at where we're at, which is turning the lens back on the leagues. That's what this whole conversation is going to be about, and asking, you know, we kind of talked about how we got here last time, but I think the question is, like, what can we do about the situation that we're in? Because I think this is going to keep happening, and it's going to keep happening because these leagues have made their own bed and now they're lying in it. Like the NBA, Adam Silver cracked down on this player after basically being one of the foremost proponents in America of legalizing sports betting. Like, this is his responsibility. He's created, not single-handedly, but in terms of like vocal, you know, sports league leaders, Adam Silver has helped like engineer this problem. And now he's all upset and he's like, oh, the integrity of sports. It's like, it feels a little rich to me. I don't know. That's where I'm starting this conversation from.
Yeah, I want to stay right there because this brings us to one of our first, I think, big philosophical discussions, which is on the one hand, and this is going to talk about the league's responsibility. On the one hand, there is a lot of money through sponsorship, through endorsement, through various things for sports leagues in the sports gambling world. And on the other hand, there is the risk of these reputational harms that can be caused by people who are involved with the league behaving badly, putting the reputation of the league in jeopardy. And so I guess philosophically, the question that Adam Silver obviously had one particular answer to, and we might have a different one, but is this slippery slope worth it at all? Like, obviously there's a lot of money to be gained, and it's true that the league is not encouraging anyone and is actually explicitly prohibiting anyone involved with the league to do anything that would cause the integrity of these games to be challenged. Mm-hmm. But is the payoff that these leagues are getting worth the risk? Because it's one thing if it's Jontay Porter saying he's ill 3 minutes into a random regular season game. It's another matter if it's I'm not going to like name somebody, but if it's like a bench player in an NBA finals game who all of a sudden can like accidentally, and I'm saying that in quotes, throw the ball out of bounds, or accidentally, and I'm saying that in quotes, foul another player and like change the outcome of an NBA finals game.
Right. And I think that is where it gets tricky, because we do obviously, the reality is that most of these players really do care. Like they got to the NBA or the NFL or the Premier League because of the dedication they have to their sport. And like that competitive drive is really important, but it's always going to be balanced against that financial drive. And the reality is, you know, Ohtani, for example, going back to Ohtani from last time, isn't really the vulnerable population we're talking about here. We're not talking about LeBron James here. We're not even really talking about Michael Porter Jr., who's Jontay Porter's brother and plays for the Nuggets and is really good and makes a lot of money every year. We are talking about the players lower on the roster who really are, they have the ability to impact games, and they also comparatively don't make a lot of money. And I think we'll see that, like, that area is the problem.
Yeah, and not just impact games. Even a player who never plays but is on a roster still has access to insider team information that would be valuable to high-level bettors. Like, yeah, like my example of a player who comes off the bench and like messes up, that's possible. But if you know that like how your team is going to rest their star players throughout the season, or if you know that someone is struggling with an unreported injury and you can slide that information to an interested party who wants to bet based on that information, you can change the outcome, not of a game, but you can certainly change the way, like give someone an unfair advantage in betting without even being on the court.
I think my fear is that like all of that is true, and yet the amount of money that these leagues, and we'll get to media in a little bit, but leagues, media organizations, teams are making from these sponsorships, I think to them probably absolutely does balance out the risk. And that's why this has happened.
Yeah.
Like when there are so many billions of dollars flooding through the legal market for gambling now, you know, there are sports books in stadiums with many sports.
Yeah.
You know, and leagues are getting a cut of that. I think the unfortunate answer to the question you posed philosophically is that, like, there's no philosophical answer. They want money, mm-hmm. and they're getting money. And that's why this has happened. And I think the problem is that, like, I would like the starting point of this to be like, this is not legal. But I don't think we're ever gonna go back to that.
Right.
You know, and so like the question that we're asking here is like, how do we show the risks of this behavior and partnership enough that we damage limit the worst problem areas that this can create? And I think, like, I do think that we have to start by thinking about the players and the staff who are kind of like the bottom, like they're ground zero, you know, for every issue that is going to affect the sports world in this regard.
Yeah. Before we get on too far from the idea of like what we've been talking about with match fixing, I just want to mention that there is a reason why every single state that has allowed sports gambling have banned gambling on the WWE. And the reason why is because the entire premise of gambling is that there's a valid competition taking place. And as soon as it's publicly known that it's actually being scripted or is being fixed in some way, as the WWE publicly is, not only do you lose the opportunity to gamble on it, but you also lose the sport. Like, it stops mm-hmm. being a sport. It starts being some other form of entertainment. So, like, if the question is, what's at risk here? The answer is quite literally everything in this market. Not only is gambling at risk, because if someone could prove that there was match fixing taking place for gambling, not only would that gambling have to stop legally because it would no longer be a valid competition, but the sport would have to stop because it would no longer be a sport. It would be scripted entertainment. And so, like, that's why we're spending multiple hours, multiple podcasts talking about this, because the stakes are high. And that's why we're heated about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a huge problem. And I've been thinking, every time I read stories about this, what I find myself getting upset about genuinely is betting being involved in college sports.
Mm.
I think we're talking about actionable things today. The first thing to me that has to go, and I don't know if it's possible to completely ban it, but I really do that sports betting should be completely banned in college sports. And the reality is, like, you know, college sports has this sort of weird relationship to money and professionalism that we've talked about a lot. But I do think that, like, the players are still amateur, at least to a degree, and they're connected to academic institutions, and academic institutions basically being tied to the gambling market, to me, it's just such a corruption of, like, anything about the academic ideal that you would want. And the fact that prop bets are allowed for players, on players in college sports, to me, is even more insane. And people are talking about, you know, trying to start initiatives to ban that. But, like, these players aren't, you know, they're making some NIL money, but nothing compared to what professional athletes are playing. Imagine the risk that a young mind that's not fully formed goes through when they're balancing, you know, a career that may never take them to the pro leagues, and they're playing football for a D1 or T2 school or whatever, in a high profile situation. And you have the question, I could make $1 million, $2 million, $3 million big in one night. And even if I'm not going to make it to the pro leagues, I'll have this payout, and then I can, you know, go party it up or whatever. You are at such risk And we've talked about how at-risk college students in general are just for gambling themselves. Now imagine putting the ability in the hands of a college athlete, you know, to be in that situation. I think that's so incredibly damaging. And I honestly am surprised that the NCAA has allowed this in any way.
Yeah.
Which is like strange. You know, I'd assume they want money, but somehow it still does kind of shock me.
Yeah, I mean, part of the premise of this podcast was that we were going to provide actual governmental policies we would like to see instituted, and I think that's the clear first one.
Yeah.
Betting on amateur sports should be completely banned, and I would defy anyone to give me not a financial but a moral justification for betting on amateur sports involving people ages 22 and under.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not allowed to place a bet in some states under that age, right? Yeah. Why should you be allowed to bet on people under that age?
Yeah. 100%, right? Yeah, completely agree.
Like, that just seems insane to me.
And it seems so clear, like, to me morally, that I don't even understand what the counter argument would be, that this would somehow be good. I think that's a great first policy that a government could enact and should enact would be, yeah.
No. And I think I'm not even as mad about outcomes of games. You know, I would like it to be completely out, but like, it is harder, especially in a team sport, to like throw the entirety of a game unless the whole team is on board, which is very unusual, obviously. But prop bets on individual players, we're going to keep seeing this. And there have been multiple stories this year that we don't have to get into for the sake of time, but like, there have been stories about college athletes and irregular betting practices involving, I think it was like Temple, I think. You know, like, this is going to be an issue and it needs to be stopped immediately.
A lot of this podcast, which is kind of what you've been talking about, is like part of what these leagues, what governments, what have to think about now is limiting temptation to athletes to ruin their sport and looking for who are the more susceptible athletes, either they're college kids who make nothing or they're professionals, like you mentioned, on the lower totem. But the fact that like we're having to think through, how can we keep these gamblers from tempting athletes into sabotaging their sport for money is crazy.
Right.
Like that's the bed that these leagues have created that they now have to kind of sift through.
Right. And there is responsibility. Like, I don't want to, these are all adults here. You know, college athletes are young adults, but they're all still adults, both in college and in professionals. And it's like, you do have some responsibility that I think you should own up to. But this is where we get into the flip side of the story. And this is why, what makes me really mad about college. And I want to talk about this for a brief moment. Both in any sport, social media abuse happens. I think that's just a reality of the world we live in. And I think college athletes would get abused online, whether betting was allowed or not. But the NCAA president wrote a letter to basically university presidents, I think it was last year. And in it, he cited a study by the NCAA that said that they'd found that roughly a third of college athletes across America, a full third, had reported receiving social media abuse specifically in regards to betting. You know, that to me, like, creating an environment where a full 30% of your athletes, which is a huge population, a full 30% are receiving abuse from real people because of betting, that to me is just like, cut it off at the source. Like, that should not be happening. And complaining about it and being like, oh, look at this huge problem, I'm like, you did this. You have created this ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, how many times have you gone on like social media and seen these videos of people like yelling at the television because an athlete like makes a garbage time three-pointer that changes the money line of that game or whatever, like changes the point differential. Yep. And these people are actually like mad that this athlete like did his job and like scored points. Like,
that's sickening.
Crazy. Before we get off of the leagues, and this is not like a policy thing. This is an image thing from my perspective. But when I imagined sports gambling happening legally, I imagined it happening like as a little black market on the side that people mm-hmm. just did, but that wasn't like talked about with the leagues. And as I think about that, I do realize that the only reason why the leagues would have lobbied for gambling to be allowed is if they were going to somehow make money off of it. And the only way for leagues to make money off of it was to give the sports betting companies more visibility in exchange for money. Like, obviously that makes sense to me. But it's just worth saying that the closer you align yourself to these gambling companies, the more your reputation is going to come into scrutiny. Every time, you know, if the Las Vegas team has BetMGM on their shirts, or if there's a DraftKings logo on the floor of the court, or if you're advertising during games, or if your social media has a sports book, all of that, I know you're making money for it, but it is only going to lead to more and more questions when a Jonte Porter 2.0 situation happens about if your sport is still legitimate. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that like we could just ban, but I wonder how much that was even a conversation inside these league offices, or if the bottom line dollar amounts just like tunnel visioned their focus away from all of these other factors that, from my perspective, threaten the survival of these sports.
I hate to say it, but every time I think about the people who run sports, I'm just like, I kind of feel sick.
Yeah.
You know, like every yeah. conversation we've had for the last 4 years, I'm like, are there any good people who aren't like actually on the field? I don't know. Genuinely.
Yeah.
I think that's a great kind of transition, though, talking about image and reputation into what I think is one of the most important topics we're going to hit on here. And that's the role ultimately of media in this whole situation. Right, because the media, the sports media ecosystem, especially TV, especially social media, is what fuels the sports industry. Because without visibility, much like without, you know, visibility for sports books, this partnership would not have happened. Without visibility in general, sports don't exist. Right?
Yeah.
And so the media plays a very important role in the sports ecosystem. And I don't know, I think maybe you can kind of start off with your thoughts, because I hadn't fully thought about it in this way until you texted me at some point a month ago with a lot of initial thoughts. But the more I've been watching for it, the more I've found it bizarre how much the journalistic integrity of sports media has been compromised by sports books in the last like year.
Yeah, I just want to like, I think, explain first what I've seen like mm-hmm. on television
yeah.
that led me to this. The first thing that I saw was during a regular season NBA game on TNT, at the first quarter break, the announcers cut back to like the halftime, like the table where mm-hmm. Shaq and Kenny and Ernie and Chuck usually sit. And there was this other guy, and I couldn't tell if he was an employee of the betting company of FanDuel or if he was an employee of TNT or Turner Media. But he basically was like, here are some of the FanDuel live bets for this game right now. And here's the bet I would make. Like, the Giannis Antetokounmpo line is at 28.5, and I would take the over, is basically what he said. Mm-hmm. And that was like a little 5-10 second little bit in the midst of the broadcast. And then I was watching ESPN, and they had a girl on who I guess worked for ESPN Bets, which is now ESPN's sports book, and also is an hour-long television program on ESPN called ESPN Bets, where they talk about the bets that they're hosting on their own company. And mm-hmm. she was explaining her rationale behind some bets. And then the host, Reese Davis, said something to the extent of, this doesn't even sound like gambling. This sounds like a no-risk investment to me. And I'm sitting there like this can't, you can't be serious right now. And then I'm watching like the tennis channel 2 days ago, and they at the end of the first set, they showed this graph, and it was the pre-game, pre-match odds for each player to win, and then the live odds next to it based on the results of the first set. And it was sponsored by another betting company. I really don't want to talk about these companies by name, or even like, they're all just like a big mush in my head. I can't separate any of them apart from each other. I just don't care. They all just, I see them, like my brain just dies inside. I just lose brain cells.
See no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil.
But like, I'm seeing this, and my first reaction was, if there's this much crossover between analyzing these games, which is what the media's job to do is, and setting fair odds, which is the job of these sports books, there are so many ways in my mind that these things could be tampered with in ways that would be completely indistinguishable to like everyone involved, everyone placing the bets, the government, the player, everyone. It would be so easy for ESPN Bets to manipulate their odds based on what their trusted source journalists are saying on ESPN the television network, that make my mind reel when I consider how much they could be tampering with their odds and impacting people's financial situations based on what who Stephen A. Smith thinks is going to win the game on ESPN First Take.
To be honest, I have no idea. There are smarter people than me who know the law better than me. To be honest, I have no clue how it's legal. Genuinely. Like, the fact that you can be sponsored by a sports book, like have a broadcast, like The Athletic writes articles about sports betting and also, you know, criticizing sports betting sometimes. They are funded in many ways. They have, I think, at least multiple. I know they have at least one, but they may have multiple sportsbook sponsorships. You know, they are intimately tied. If you listen to Athletic podcasts, there is like just like reams of sportsbook advertising. The same thing is true with NFL Network stuff. Now, the NFL Network crew, as far as I understand, are banned from betting personally, which I think is good. I'm not sure if that's a rule for all media, but at least that's an internal rule for them, which I think is awesome. Talking about an initial rule, I don't think that any member of sports media should be allowed to place sports bets for exactly the reason you just said.
Well, could I just say, like,
sure,
that wouldn't even be a new law. That would just be applying the current insider trading laws that we have on the stock market to this issue.
Like, because this is the stock market, essentially.
Right.
I don't understand how it's like genuinely, like, I don't understand how it's allowed.
If you were in a position to have off the record or on the record conversations with athletes or league executives or team executives and get information, whether you release it to the public or not, you cannot bet. You should not be able, for the same reason that if you sit in congressional briefings, you can't then go manipulate the stock market based on the information that only you know. That's just basic insider trading law that is, as far as I can tell, not being applied to gambling.
And you have an obvious conflict of interest if your newspaper or TV station or whatever is sponsored by FanDuel. You have an obvious interest in making FanDuel money. So if you then go on air and say, you should bet this money line, it's a no-risk investment, and you're not saying with a disclaimer, I'm sponsored by FanDuel, please don't take this as financial advice, which is what all financial advisors have to do everywhere they post stuff. Well, I mean, understand how it's allowed.
Rhys Davis should have been fired for that comment. Straight up.
I don't get it. I genuinely don't. Like, if you hear financial advisors talk about finances and talk about the stock market, they are filled with disclaimers because they know that they'll get in serious legal trouble if they have, basically, if they're giving people false financial advice. It's a huge deal. And somehow the law is just not being applied here. And I don't know enough to say whether the laws apply here or not. But to me, if they don't, they should. And it's just it's a clear delineation that I don't get it. I really don't.
If you're wondering like practically what I'm worried about, like here's an example. Let me just a hypothetical example. First Take does a segment tomorrow. Game 3 of the Lakers game. Is LeBron going to go for 30 points or whatever? Stephen A. Smith goes on TV and says, 100% yes, you can lock it in. LeBron James is going to go for 30 plus points. Now, all these people, I'm not one of them, who believe that Stephen A. Smith is the god of basketball and take his word as a trusted source. He's a quote unquote expert in the field of basketball. Go on to ESPN Bets. The odds makers that are owned by the same company as the TV network that just aired that segment, they could go in there completely justified and just raise the over on LeBron James's points by a little bit. Maybe you make it 31.5, or maybe you make it 30.5. You just boost it more than you otherwise normally would have because you know that maybe it's hundreds, maybe it's thousands, maybe it's tens of thousands of people will just take Stephen A. Smith's word for it and place money based on the bet that he said he would take. You all of a sudden, you have tampering. And because it is literally owned by the same network, the same company, as far as I tell, there's no way to like track that.
It's insane. And I think this is what I'm mad about this. I'm genuinely mad. This is the most mad I'm going to be in this segment. I'm mad about this because lay all the legal stuff aside, and we come to the question of journalistic standards and journalistic ethics. Sports media is obviously about a largely lighthearted topic, but the rules of journalism and of what it means to be a journalist still apply. People bend them all the time, especially in sports media for obvious reasons, but there are still rules. And how you can like look yourself in the mirror and go out into public and tweet, why does the public not trust journalists? And then say this stuff and have your media company say this stuff and actively try to like essentially mislead people into making money with sports books. And then say, gee, I wonder why people think that the media is super biased and hates me. Well, you know, there may be a reason. And the reason is that you don't care about people and you don't care about your own standards. And that to me is, it's frankly appalling. Genuinely. Yeah. Yeah. I find it disgusting. And I think that any media organization that participates in this should be ashamed of themselves. And that's why, you know, there are many places that I disagree with The Guardian on politically in so many ways. I could make a Word document reams long of political things that I disagree with The Guardian on. But The Guardian, it was either last year or the year before, put out a statement and said, we are not, for ethical reasons, we are not running any gambling ads in our newspaper or our digital publication or any of our podcasts. And that means they lose a lot of income, but that means they are also preserving their journalistic voice. And I think that's crucial. And I think any media organization that does not do that should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah, it makes me think of like that example I gave of the TNT basketball game where this guy, who has this unclear who he works for. It's unclear what his exact title is, but he comes on TV and says, you should take the Giannis Antetokounmpo over at 29.5. And then I don't know how many people at FanDuel, because this segment is brought to you by FanDuel. And then I don't know how many people go and do that. And this is a fact, Giannis Antetokounmpo ends that game at 29 points, which is the under, after this guy said to take the over. And I'm sure this guy went home and had a great night's sleep because to him, it's all just a game and it's all just his job. But like, I guarantee you that people put real money down in their lives based on what he said, and they didn't go to bed half as content as he did because it was probably just a game to him. But to other people like who viewed him as an expert, this actually meant something to them. And he doesn't care that he just like discredited himself on national television because he's cashing the FanDuel checks, not from gambling.
So policy number two.
Yeah.
Reporter ban should happen.
Yeah.
Policy number two. I think it violates your journalistic standards if you are sponsored by a sports book. However, if you do take that sponsorship money, which I think is, it's not the worst thing in the world. It's definitely not my favorite, but it's not the end of the world. I think you absolutely, under no circumstances, can give betting advice. I think that absolutely has to be outlawed.
Yeah. And, like, I agree. Like, obviously, in sports media, like, these people are going to predict games. Mm-hmm. They sometimes will talk in their analysis. Like, if Stephen A. Smith said, I think LeBron will go for 30 tonight.
Yep.
Or if he says, I think the New York Jets are going to win this game. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, when it's presented to you as, Stephen A., here are the odds brought to you by ESPN Bets. Which side are you taking? That's a completely different framing. Even if it's the same question, it's a very, very sleazy way to frame that segment, and it should not be allowed at all.
Yeah, I think it's complicated. Like, I find myself thinking about the shows I listen to. Like, obviously, like, there's a money line for every NFL game. And I think, like, thinking about it in a sports, I think it would be hard to delineate, because I think, like, thinking about it in a sports way, people will ask the questions like, is this really accurate? You know, will the Chiefs really win by 8 points, you know? Or is that, like, is that odd? Is there something strange here? Like, could we have an upset? Whatever. You know, like, there is legitimate sports talk that happens from those. But I do think that, like, the line has to be drawn somewhere. And I do think direct betting advice is definitely where the line has to be drawn. I think you can probably say, you know, I think I might take Thunder on this one. I don't know. But, like, in a general sense, but I think if you have, like, a sponsored segment where you're giving betting advice, to me seems definite no-go.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've excoriated the leagues.
Yeah.
We've excoriated the media. Mm-hmm. We're going to do the rest of our laws. We're going to do the rest of our laws in a second. But one thing that I want to talk about briefly, and I think we could do this pretty quickly. Using the Jontay Porter example as a benchmark, players who are caught tampering related to gambling, mm-hmm. what should the punishment be?
I think they have to be banned.
Yeah.
Permanently. I think it's the right call. I think the questions about, you know, should players be banned for more games for domestic abuse? I think we both agree, yes. But I don't think that changes the fact that if you take this step, your time in the league has to be over. I think that's a rule that should be very clear.
Agreed. Yeah, okay. That's easy.
All right.
That's cool. Easy.
Next.
any other laws that we've thought of? Anything else you want to pitch to Joe Biden, to Mike Johnson, to Chuck Schumer, to anyone else who may be listening with pull up on Capitol Hill?
Mm-hmm. I would say, so the UK in many ways has been very ahead of us in that gambling laws have been very lax. Sports gambling is just literally everywhere in Premier League soccer. It's, you know, on every advertising board on the side of the field. It's on almost every shirt. Like, it's all over the place. And because of that, because they've been established, they've spent a lot of time thinking about regulation, that they're trying to pull things back a little bit now in a way that we're not doing right now, because we're just full speed ahead here in the States. And I think one law that stood out to me, one is that they're starting in, I think, the 2026 season, they're banning front of shirt sponsors being betting companies. So it can still be around the field and it can be on the side of your shirt, like on your sleeve, but it's not going to be the primary thing everyone sees when they look at your jersey and buy your jersey and stuff, which I think, just from an advertising standpoint, that's solid, whatever. The really interesting rule that I think makes a lot of sense and contrasts so much with the current state of sportsbook advertising here is, I believe, is it in 2022, ahead of the World Cup, the UK instituted a ban in advertising, basically, of celebrities in sportsbook ads. So you can still have a readout, you know, in Athletic Soccer Podcast. You can have a readout talking about the local sportsbook. It'll read all the disclaimers and whatever. But you can't have Premier League players, managers. You can't have TV stars. You can't have social media celebrities featuring in any of these advertisements.
How do they define that? Do you know?
I don't know the exact specifics.
Yeah.
But it can't, basically the distinction is like you can't have it with like video game imagery. And basically what it comes back to is they're basically saying like, if you are targeting people under 25 with this advertisement specifically, like specifically children, you under no circumstances can be like adding extra lures to draw these kids in to look at your product and hook them early. They're like, if you're going to sports gamble, go sports gamble, have fun. But you can't, you know, bring Kevin DeBruyne and Erling Haaland in and say, hey, kids, go gamble responsibly.
Yeah.
Not allowed. And I think that's a great rule because when you look at our advertising, it's completely celebrity driven and it creates this
Rob Gronkowski and Kevin Hart would be out of a job.
Mm-hmm. And what, Jamie Foxx too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
He was the first one, I'm pretty sure. I think if you cut out that celebrity like lure, I think you do remove some of the sheen of saying like, oh, look at this fun environment that we've created. Come join us. It's all fun and games here. And I, you know, people will kick and scream, but the government should do its job and like be responsible at least a little bit.
Yep.
That would be great.
Yep. I have some laws that I think are pretty good.
Really?
If anyone's interested. And I at first I was thinking about this, like, what are the other like types of either addiction law or like financial laws that are already in place that we could just apply to gambling? Mm-hmm. I already mentioned insider trading. If you have access to special information about something that would affect a game, you can't bet on that and you can't give that information to anyone else. That's a law. Mm-hmm. Follow it. But then I was also thinking about how like we have laws that stop, that prevent the vendors of addictive substances from continuing to provide that substance to addicted people. For example, it is a crime for a bartender to serve a visibly drunk person. That's why bartenders go through extensive training to identify people who are inebriated past the point they should be and know how to cut that person off from buying more drinks. I think that there would be an easy way with the technology that we have to prevent people from gambling after a certain threshold of losses take place. Like, mm-hmm. you could freeze their account for a certain period of time if they have maybe a certain amount of consecutive losses, lost bets in a certain amount of time, or like an unusually large single bet that they lose. So maybe like you say, let's say you lose $20,000 as a bet, anything over five figures. If you lose that bet, mm-hmm. your account is stopped for like 12 hours, 24 hours. I don't know. Experts can figure that out. Or maybe you lose four, five bets in a row. And no matter the dollar amount, your account is frozen for 12 hours, something like that. Just like mm-hmm. you could enforce a break. Like you could legally enforce a pause so that these people can't get in the cycle of immediately then trying to get back your loss by gambling more and more and more and potentially losing more and more and more and more. You could stop that snowball from happening by just stop serving them for a little bit. Put them on a break. I think that could be something that could be implemented right now. Another thing that they could do would be mandatory like addiction warnings before every single bet. Like if you place a bet, you could get one more pop-up that says, I understand that gambling can be addictive and I'm aware that this number is the gambling hotline if I need any gambling services. Mm-hmm. And you could put that as an extra pop-up for every single bet people place every single time. That might be annoying. That might mess up the app experience. I don't care. Like, just put that message in front of people every single time. Just like you can't buy a carton of cigarettes without it having a warning label on it. Mm-hmm. Every single carton has that warning label. Yep. And I think every single bet can and should have one too. The last thing, and I'm not sure about this one, but, and this is something that at least FanDuel already does from my limited experience as a FanDuel bettor. You can go back to previous podcast to learn more about that. But
it's really an interesting arc in our podcast history.
But there was a way with certain bets that you could cash out the bet at any time, whether you're up or whether you're down. Obviously, you wouldn't get the full amount either way. Like, if you cashed out and you're losing, you wouldn't get it all back, but you get less than you would lose if you let it go to term. And if you wanted to cash out while you're ahead, you wouldn't get the full payout. You get a reduced payout. But I like that idea. Like, it has like a like a refund, like a regret kind of thing. Like, or like if a situation happens, like you bet. I keep using the Lakers because they're in the playoffs. But let's say you bet $80 on LeBron on the Lakers to win, and then 3 minutes into the game, LeBron tears his ACL. Lord forbid. Like, you shouldn't then be stuck with that entire bet to term because something drastically happened to change the outcome of that game that was that changes the odds. And so while you couldn't get all 80 back, if there was a feature where you could cash out and maybe get $20 back, that's better than nothing. And I liked the way that FanDuel did that. I don't know if that's what all do or if that's something that you could make them all do, or if that's maybe just like a best practice and not a law. But I thought that was a nice way to kind of give people flexibility in their betting and not feel like after you place a bet, you're locked into it to the full extent of it to term, regardless of whatever circumstances may change. And even if you can only get a quarter or half of your initial investment back, that could still save someone's life in some cases.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Yeah, I think legislating that one seems like the least likely to me to actually be a law.
Yeah,
but I
agree.
Think would be a nice best practice. I do think the first two things you said are crucial. I think an addiction warning, 100% valid. And like, I think that is the one that is most likely to actually happen. Because, I mean, the government's trying to regulate social media right now as an addictive substance, basically. So if social media is going to get hit with that, you know, and social media makes the government plenty of money as well. I do think that gambling will get hit with that kind of regulation. And I do think that, you know, sports books will push back on spending limits because obviously they want to take advantage of people. But if someone's hooked, I mean, if they wait 12 hours, they're still going to come back. So I really don't.
Yeah, we don't
lose that much money.
Yeah, and that's like we don't let the bar keep exploiting people just because they keep buying drinks.
Like you can go back the next day,
right? Sure. But it's legal. Like it's not like as long as you're spending money, we're allowed to do this. Like no, it doesn't matter if you can get $20 more out of them on 4 more beers. There's a point where you have to stop, yeah. And that can and should be true here too.
I think those are all great, and I think we're going to need those and a lot more to like harness this thing.
John, do you think we should run for office on a gambling only platform? Like the Crunching Tackles Party is here to save, to fix gambling.
I feel like we wouldn't get elected. I hate to say it.
I mean, either
people are against us, unfortunately.
Seems to be.
I think that we should run on like a secret platform of anti-gambling and then like suddenly reveal our platform after we've been elected. I think that would really work.
Yeah, that's how democracy works. Deceive the voters.
Much like the sports media organizations we've been discussing. I think it's a winning move.
Yeah. Anything else on this topic, John? Anything else you want to say about gambling? I'm sure we're going to come back to it again on a future podcast, but for now at least.
Yeah, I think we've talked about it plenty. I keep coming back to the conflict of interest. And when I think about what are the pressing moral issues here that must be resolved, my mind can't shake those media ties. And I think that and the college sports issue are two things that are just going to keep becoming more and more egregious, and we need to deal with it now and rather than later.
Yeah, they're huge. They're huge points. I actually hadn't thought about the college one until you mentioned it just now. And I did see the effort to kind of stop player betting in college. No-brainer. No, like I said, can't think of a reason not to. But I guess I would say that if you are someone who's listening to this and you passionately disagree with us, I would love to hear the best case of the opposition. Obviously, I don't think John and I's stances on this are going to be changing anytime soon, but obviously we also enjoy interacting with arguments. And if someone has a good case they'd like to put before us, I'm all ears.
I'd say we're willing debaters at all times. That's the Crunching Tackles brand.
Yeah, so. That's how we don't duck. We don't duck from nobody.
Mm-mm. You know who else doesn't duck? Chad.
Hit me.
The journalists in Alex Garland's new film, Civil War.
I'm so excited to talk about this movie, not because it's a great movie, which it is. Right, I think you and I both find this movie good / great and interesting, but I think we both find the discourse around this movie fascinating.
Oh, well, I find one thing even more fascinating than that, and that's just the man, the myth, the legend, Jesse Plemons, who is hitting levels of side character and like goated energy that maybe like not fully unprecedented, but like it feels like in our era are unprecedented.
Jesse Plemons can do more to a movie in 5 minutes than a lot of other more famous actors can do in 2 hours.
That's just objectively true. He appears on screen in his insane red sunglasses, and literally I was like on the edge of my seat, like jumping, like, go see it. I'm not going to spoil what happens, but I literally every action of his, I'm literally jumping in my seat.
Unbelievably tense.
Do you want to talk about the discourse?
Yeah.
I think you I have thoughts, but I think you have more.
Yeah. I mean, this movie is called Civil War. It's an imagining of what Civil War in America in our current day would look like, not our previous one, like we had a Civil War, but this would be a new one. It imagines which states might be aligned. It hints at but doesn't explicitly talk about the reasons why. But ultimately, it's a movie written and directed by Alex Garland, the director of Ex Machina, as his good stuff, and Annihilation as his bad stuff, as this podcast agrees. that is committed to showing what the horrors of war would look like on U.S. soil. It has a committed style to aggressively and with no apologies portray what division, violence, militia warfare, guerrilla warfare, military on military warfare in the states amongst our citizens would be like, and how people would respond to it, how journalists would respond, how soldiers would respond, how people in small towns minding their own business pretending none of it was happening would respond, how towns of armed citizen militias with AK-47s will respond, the whole gamut. And this movie has been criticized by people, I think, who wanted it to take a more explicit position on the political makeup of what the Civil War would be like. They wanted it to be more like of a political drama than a military drama. They wanted the Aaron Sorkin or the Oliver Stone or the Adam McKay version of Civil War and not the Alex Garland version. And I don't understand. I think anyone who wants that is truly missing Alex Garland's point, because it's not an apolitical film. It's an anti-right versus left film. Like, it has a political message to it, but its message is not, if we have a civil war, it's because the right is wrong and the left is right. Or if we have a civil war, it's because the flip side of that. It's basically saying in America, there is still more that unites us than divides us. And that is our democracy. And there are people who would like to take that democracy away from us. And there's from various ideological standpoints. And they are the enemies. And they are the ones that we must stop. And it does vaguely hint, not even vaguely, you can tell that Donald Trump is the inspiration of the president of the United States in the movie. You can just tell. Like, the film opens with him saying, he's announcing a victory, and he's like, some are saying this is the greatest victory in the history of the world. Like, we know who talks like that. He's wearing a red tie. This is not that difficult. But at the same time, it's not a movie committed to showing us why we're divided. It's a movie committed to showing us why being divided isn't worth it when bullets start firing. And I think it's super impactful. And I just want people to see it and to take its ideas seriously on its terms and not try to impose what you wanted it to be or the way you wanted it to validate the feelings that you had going into it?
Well, the reality is that plenty of people who are mad about this movie are mad because they want to feel that their side is right and validated by this movie.
That's right.
Right? And like your statement, this movie is not about the left or the right being right, is what is making people mad. Because people want to feel right. They want to feel that their opinion has been established. Like, wow, from a left-wing person, Donald Trump is the reason that a civil war started in this country. People want to see that on screen. And this movie doesn't say that. And so people got mad. It's like, what a silly, in my opinion, what a silly reason to be mad at a movie for. Like, why is that the movie? I'm not interested in that movie. Maybe you are. I don't know. But I thought what this movie did really well, and it follows journalists trying to track this war. What it followed, ultimately, the reality, which is that, like, if you know war, if you've experienced war, if your family has experienced war, you know that there may be ideological reasons that a war happens, but when it comes down to it, the war gets ugly, and the reasons the people are fighting on the ground are not the reasons that the war is being fought in the boardroom. Much like All Quiet on the Western Front kind of illustrates, both in the movie but also very much in the book, that normal people fight for normal people reasons that are not ideological. And when you're on the front lines, all that kind of stuff, the high-minded stuff, burns away. And you're like, I want to survive today. I would like to see if I have loved ones left. I would like to see them tomorrow. You know, like, that's what war comes down to. And this movie does a really good job of illustrating that. And the people who are like, the people who are privileged enough to have not experienced that in any way, shape, or form, and say, man, I wish this movie was more ideological and showed me an unrealistic version of war. I would like you to go take a trip to somewhere where there is war happening in the world right now and think long and hard about your stance on a movie like this. Because the reality, when we make war movies about other countries where we're not emotionally involved, wars are often depicted like this. Because just like in Vietnam, you know, there's a huge conflict between quote-unquote freedom and quote-unquote evil. You know, and I would say that communist regimes are and were evil. But when you're on the ground of Vietnam, those lines get blurred, right? Because everyone, to a degree, has evil inside them. And the reasons you're fighting there become very different from the reasons that Lyndon B. Johnson is talking about on TV.
Yeah.
And I think that's what this movie is trying to say. And I think you're right that if you miss that, you miss the whole point of the movie.
Yeah. I guess to me, I've been surprised by how the impulsive reaction to this movie is that it's not provocative. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it is by far the most provocative movie of the year so far, and one of the more provocative movies I've seen, hence the discourse that has taken place about it, hence the fact that a full 3 weekends after its release, it's still dominating a lot of cultural conversation, or I guess 2 weeks, but still. And I guess this is again, just a brief chance to recommend something that I think is really well considered in its creative design and is designed to cause you to want to think about it more. And I think that people should be thinking about this movie and they should see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also just want to say the action sequences are really, really good.
Really good.
I was very impressed.
Really, really good. He's got a gift. The guns sound like real guns in a movie theater.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really loud. I was shocked. I saw it on IMAX and I was absolutely shocked at how loud it was when the first gun went off. I like literally almost jumped in my seat.
They're jump scares. They really are. I would just like to say, and I should have said this earlier, but like, if you name any movie in the history of the 100 years of cinema, every single movie would be better with 5 minutes of Jesse Plemons in it.
think that's just true.
That's just how I feel.
That's the take that we're concluding this podcast on. That is the right take.
That guy has the good stuff.
He does. I was blown away. I also forgot that he was married to Kirsten Dunst, and they're literally on screen together in this scene. No spoilers. And it's just like, it kind of just, it blew me away. I can't imagine watching your husband behave in that way and staying married to them afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a marriage testing scene to be sure. Yeah. Good stuff. I hope that this is a podcast that we get some feedback on. So if you have any thoughts, let us know. Look to the social medias where we're going to start posting some short video versions of this podcast. Just some vertical video content for the social media feeds. We're excited about doing that and
changing with the times.
Yeah, we're trying to stay relevant in the ever turning media landscape.
That's right.
But the one thing that we can promise you is that Crunching Tackles will never, under any circumstance, be brought to you by a sports gambling company.
So I can 100% guarantee that.
That is
for
one
so
way we will not be changing with the times.
We will not be bought out by Saudi Arabia, and we will not be bought out by a sports book. We are consistent.
And
is that
on
because
that
we're not noticed by them? Maybe, but that's not important.
Yeah, and on that note, John, after a honestly an insufferable amount of patting ourselves on the back for that, I think we should go.
Thank you guys for listening.
Yeah, thank you guys. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another podcast, probably not about gambling, although we're not entirely sure what it will be about. So TBD, we'll figure it out. We do have one idea that I'm excited about. So
that's true.
John and I will workshop that, and you can stay subscribed so you can know when that podcast will drop. And until then, we hope that you all continue to be well and be safe, and we'll talk to you later.
All right. Cheers, guys.